Hello and welcome to episode 3 of Space Talks, a science-based show with particular interests in all things space. This is Stephen Lowry along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim, how are you today?
Couldn't be better, Steve. Looking forward to today's show.
Now, in the last episode, we mentioned a couple of topics that we may explore. I think you've taken a look at some of them, Tim. What are some of the topics that we are going to be talking about in the future?
To tell you the truth, Steve, I think we have to admit that our list is growing. It's just incredible how many new ideas and topics that are springing to mind. But I have picked out a couple of favorites to mention today. Science fiction movies, space capsules like the SpaceX, the Starship, and the Dragon, Martian robotic rovers, the multiverse, space debris, which is something that tied into our previous episode. And finally, here's another one that's going to have to put your thinking caps on, the expanding universe and dark matter. Any of those tickle your fancy?
Well, they do. And they almost fall into two categories, those which are real and definable, such as space debris and rovers on Mars, and those which are perhaps more theoretical in nature, such as the origins of the universe and dark energy and dark matter, which are perhaps in the realms of Sheldon Cooper at times.
sometimes you turn on a TV show and they have warnings about the content being potentially unhappy making, sexual or violence. I wonder whether we're going to need a warning when we start talking about the multiverse or the expanding universe and dark matter so that people are, you know, sitting down or whatever one might do when we start asking them to think about infinity.
Right. Buckle up your seatbelts, folks. Here we go. I know exactly what you mean.
So, Steve, we better get on to today's topic, which is stellar evolution.
Yeah, stellar evolution, which means the birth, the main life, and the death of stars. And that's metaphorically speaking. It's hard to imagine that astronomers and astrophysicists talk about inanimate objects, hydrogen, helium, and so on, having a death. But they do. And my introduction to stellar evolution was in an astrophysics class I took at Carleton University many years ago. And I was very fortunate in that it was led by Dr. Lauren Avery, who was working out of the National Research Council in Ottawa. And up to that point, my knowledge of stars was indeed basically our sun and a few constellations, and was pretty much limited to, ooh, look at that shiny thing in the sky. And this course was a complete revelation to me. And I should start off with a quote from a theoretical physicist named Dr. Lawrence Krauss. And though he was born in New York City, he went to school in Toronto, and he got his first class honors in mathematics and physics also at Carleton University in Ottawa, and his PhD in physics at MIT. And his quote is, "The amazing thing is that every atom in your body came from a star that exploded. And the atoms in your left hand probably came from a different star than your right hand. It really is the most poetic thing I know about physics. You are all stardust." And of course, Joni Mitchell used that little phrase too in her song about Woodstock, "We Are Stardust." And I would like to add that Krauss's 2012 book, A Universe from Nothing, is an absolute must read for those interested in cosmology. Or if you don't want to read the book, his lectures can be viewed on YouTube.
Well, we have to mention cosmology, which is the study of the origin of the universe, before we can delve into the life cycle of stars. Big Bang nucleosynthesis is believed to have taken place at the interval from roughly 10 seconds to 20 minutes immediately after the Big Bang. During the first 20 minutes, the first 20 hot minutes of the universe, all of the hydrogen and helium that there is or ever will be was created from energy in the ratio of 75% hydrogen and 25% helium. Then, as the universe underwent a sudden and extreme expansion, temperatures dropped, ceasing the formation of other elements such as carbon, oxygen, or metals such as gold. Some 30 minutes after the creation of the universe, there was nothing except hydrogen and helium, the two lightest elements.
And I've read that in many sources, and I find that extremely hard to wrap my head around. But eons ago, large clusters of these hydrogen gas nebulae did begin to coalesce or shrink under its own gravitational forces. because all mass has gravity. And when things get compressed, they begin to heat up. And, you know, from an ordinary point of view, we use this phenomenon when we create a snowball. If you take a cluster of snow in your left hand and another cluster in your right hand, and you put the two of them together and you squeeze them to make a snowball, compacting the crystals of snow causes micro-melting at their edges. And when you open your hands to release the compression, there's an instant expansion and cooling, which causes the edges to freeze and stick together. And so that's why it's really easy to do when it's nice and warm out, and why it's extremely difficult to make a snowball when it's very, very cold out, minus 20, minus 30 degrees, because you can't exert enough pressure on the crystals to create any melting at that point. And in a similar fashion, the collapsing hydrogen gas got hotter and hotter enough, and finally it reached enough temperatures to create thermonuclear fusion. And that is the transmutation of hydrogen into helium. That is, if you compress two hydrogens together, you create helium. Now, if uncontrolled, you create a hydrogen bomb, and that's something that humans know how to do. But our sun, which is a typical star, doesn't simply blow up when it first reaches thermonuclear temperatures. Instead, we have a sphere, and that's because you have the gravity pulling all the mass downwards, but then you have the energy pushing outwards. So the outwards pressure is equalized by the inwards pressure, and you get a sphere, and they call that hydrostatic equilibrium.
So for all stars, their main life is characterized by the conversion of hydrogen and helium in its core while releasing all forms of electromagnetic radiation from short wavelengths such as ultraviolet energy to longer wavelengths such as heat, visible light, and radio waves. Now, the really interesting thing about stellar evolution is not so much how they begin and live, but how they die. Listeners are probably familiar with that rocker adage, live fast, die young, and leave a good-looking corpse. Well, they weren't the first ones to come up with that adage. Stars have been doing that since the beginning of time with their credo of burn hot, live fast, die young, and leave an unbelievable corpse.
Well, even very young people looking up at the night sky can see that all stars aren't the same. Some appear bigger, some are brighter, some seem very close to one another. However, we know that appearances can be deceiving. A star may be bright because it's relatively close to us, or it may be bright because of its huge size. It wasn't until the discovery that light can be split into its constituent colors that stellar light began to be examined. And so when Isaac Newton used a glass prism to examine the nature of the rainbow of colors, he determined that they constitute part of sunlight, and that the rainbow of colors wasn't the result of some sort of contamination in the glass prism. And here's something which shows the human nature of Isaac Newton. His contemporary, Robert Boyle, noted that there were only five colors, and he deemed them to be red, yellow, green, blue, and purple. Newton came up with seven colors by adding orange, and he split the color purple into indigo and violet. And he did this because he believed seven to be a mystical and magical perfect number. I guess he proved that even geniuses have their quirks.
Absolutely true. I don't think there's one that doesn't. As optical equipment became more sophisticated, it was discovered that the burning of elements when viewed through a spectroscope produces bright lines at specific wavelengths, somewhat akin to our fingerprints, with each element emitting its own particular bright line wavelengths. In 1868, the French physicist Pierre Janssen noted an unknown bright line in sunlight and surmised it was a new element. Confirmed by Englishman Joseph Lockyer, they called the element helium after the Greek word for sun. And so it was that helium was first discovered in a star before its existence was even known on Earth.
Using newly invented spectroscopes allowed future scientists, notably the American astronomer Annie Jump Cannon, to analyze and categorize stars according to their composition, mass, and luminosity, and placing them on a chart which is now called the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, which is used to this day.
Main sequence stars make up the vast majority of all stars. Using our sun as the standard, stars with solar masses up to 10 times that of our sun will convert hydrogen to helium for about 10 billion years before using up all of their hydrogen. Then, because they begin to emit less outward energy, they collapse under their own gravity, but shrinking causes temperatures to rise, and now in the even hotter core, helium can be converted to carbon. Then, through progressive stages, into oxygen, neon, silicon, and iron, in shells rather like the layers of an onion.
And that's really strange to think. If you cut an onion in half and you can see those layers, you would see that inside a star at that particular point. You would have hydrogen, helium, oxygen, neon, and progressive layers outward. That process is called stellar nucleosynthesis, but eventually these layers of newly created elements get blown off into space, leaving behind a small, dense core called a white dwarf, which lacks the heat required to fuse any other elements. And the white dwarf, called white because it glows white hot, but it's still not hot enough to be thermonuclear in nature, slowly cools and eventually becomes a small black dwarf, radiating no light or heat. And that's the fate of our sun. And when Dr. Avery told us about this, I was absolutely astounded. Had never heard of the term white dwarf, had never heard of the term black dwarf.
Earlier, we were talking about stars like our own sun, which as it ages will become a red giant. That's a phase where the sun will get larger and larger and eventually engulf our planet Earth. Then our sun will cool, becoming a small black dwarf and radiate no light or heat. That is the fate of our sun.
Well, that's not very reassuring that we're going to become incinerated.
No, it isn't great. But unlike our sun, which lives for about 10 billion years, let's look at a star which is 30 times as massive as the sun. You'd think that having 30 times as much fuel, it would last 30 times longer. But quite the opposite is true. Now, to understand that, let's use the analogy of two people with sums of money standing in the place of hydrogen fuel. One fellow, he's just stuck with a miserable $100, while the other has 30 times as much. He's standing around with $3,000 in his pockets. The question is, if each day they spend money, who's going to run out of money first? Well, it would seem logical to imagine that starting with $100, that individual is going to exhaust his supply and start going hungry long before the other fellow. However, if the one with $100 spends just $1 a day, he's got 100 days. The other fellow, the free spender who has $3,000, is going to be spending $200 per day. He's going to run out of his money in just 15 days. And so it is with massive stars. A star with a mass 30 times that of our sun will only last 11 million years, which is only 1/1000th the lifespan of our sun. When it runs out of hydrogen, it too will undergo a series of expansion and contraction, creating elements up to iron. But whereas this was as far as main sequence stars could go, these massive stars suddenly undergo a sudden and violent collapse, shrinking at a rate of 70,000 kilometers in a second, which is about 23% the speed of light. In a fraction of a second, the sudden rise in heat and pressure creates a supernova nucleosynthesis of all the elements above iron, elements such as copper, zinc, silver, gold, platinum, and uranium. In what is known as a supernova explosion, these elements are scattered through the universe. The remaining core is an amazingly dense mass called a neutron star, which are only about 10 kilometers across in size, but retain a mass greater than our own sun. To put this in perspective, a teaspoon, just a single teaspoon of this neutron star, would have the mass of 3 billion tons. Its magnetic field is 100 million times that of Earth's, and its gravity is 200 billion that of Earth's.
When I was doing some research, I found out they also spin amazingly fast because of something which is known as the law of angular momentum. So if you watched a figure skater, they spin faster and faster by simply pulling in their arms and legs. Well, so too a neutron star spins fast as it collapses in size. And they rotate as fast as hundreds of times per second. And neutron stars, which emit electromagnetic radiation as they spin, are called pulsars. And pulsars is a portmanteau for pulsating radio source. And the very first one to be discovered was by a British astrophysicist named Jocelyn Bell. And she was working on her doctorate degree under Antony Hulish. And on August 6, 1967, using a newly commissioned radio telescope, which she helped build, she and her supervisor picked up these strange bursts of energy. Now, they had no idea what it was. And so in a rather whimsical bit of fashion, they nicknamed this phenomenon as LGM-1, LGM standing for Little Green Men. Well, that pulsar is now known as CP-1919. Now, here's the unfortunate thing about Jocelyn Bell, and indeed women in general in branches of science. She was given virtually no credo at the time for her discovery. Her supervisor, Antony Hulish, took the majority of the kudos for the discovery, and he was awarded the Nobel Prize for this in 1974. The most famous supernova created is the so-called Crab Nebula, recorded by the Chinese way back in 1054. And yet, at the center is a pulsar which was discovered only in 1968 by, yes, the aforementioned Jocelyn Bell. She discovered that as well. The cloud of ejected gas from that nebula from the supernova explosion is moving outwards in all directions at an unbelievable rate of 1,500 kilometers per second. And the 20-kilometer pulsar, which is left behind, is rotating at a speed of 30 times per second.
Now, the next question with regard to stellar evolution is, what happens to truly big stars that are more than 30 stellar masses in size?
And here's where we get into those unbelievable corpses that we talked about earlier. So let's say a star has 60 solar masses. That means 60 times the mass of our sun. So we talked about a star with 30 solar masses lasting for 11 million years. But a star with 60 solar masses only lasts 3 million years. And the death is ultraviolet. Now, as with main sequence stars and massive stars, it too undergoes a supernova nucleosynthesis, creating all the elements heavier than iron, and it too blasts them into space while shrinking. But here's where the bizarre really occurs. And it must admit, here's where Dr. Lauren Avery just took delicious delight in trying to explain it to us. Now, because of the enormous gravity, the core never stops shrinking. So if you take a handful of snow in either hand, you compress it, you know you can only shrink it so far. And on Earth, for all practical matters, we say that water is non-compressible. Well, in a supermassive star, which is shrinking, there's no such thing as reaching a limit where you can't compress it further. It keeps shrinking and shrinking down to a point of nothing. And yet it maintains the mass. All of the mass is still there in a singular point. And indeed, they call it singularity.
That's just the science behind that is just hard to conceive. Perhaps we should explain a couple of terms at this point. Nova is Latin for new, which refers to what appears to Earth observers as a temporary new bright star suddenly appearing, seemingly out of nowhere. The other term is black hole, where black is an adjective, refers to the fact that gravity is so intense that nothing can escape it, not even light.
Well, Tim, we have presented a lot of amazing facts this episode, and some of them can be truly confusing. How about if we do a recap of the deaths of stars?
Well, the first observation, it brings me back to my father, who used to say the bigger they are, the harder they fall. Main sequence stars produce the elements up to iron and fade away as white dwarfs and finally black dwarfs.
Massive stars also create elements up to and including iron, and then in an instant of sudden implosion, going from the size of the orbit of Mars down to the size of salmon arm in a fraction of 1 second, they create all the elements heavier than iron. Now, if that wasn't enough, in another fraction of a second, they violently explode and hurl those elements into space during a supernova explosion. What remains are unbelievably dense and rapidly spinning neutron stars and pulsars.
Supermassive stars create those same heavy elements and disappear into black holes.
So the implication here, Tim, is that at the very beginning of the birth of the universe, within the first up to 3 minutes, you only had hydrogen and helium created. Everything else, the things that we're looking at right now, the constituent components of our smartphones, our desks, lamps, food, all of those things were created in stars, some in medium-sized stars, some in massive stars. And the truly massive stars, we can't even see anymore because they've disappeared into nothing. Because these massive stars are so amazing, Tim, I'd like to backtrack a bit to highlight Dr. Jocelyn Bell, who discovered the first pulsar and was denied her share of the Nobel Prize. Jocelyn Bell was born in Northern Ireland, and her father was an architect who helped design a planetarium. And during her visits there, the staff encouraged her to pursue a career in astronomy. She then attended the preparatory department of Lurgan College at a time when boys could study technical subjects, but girls were expected to study subjects such as cooking and cross-stitching. And she was able to study science only after her parents and others challenged the school's policies. She graduated from the University of Glasgow with a Bachelor of Science degree with honors physics, and while obtaining her PhD degree at Cambridge, she helped construct the Interplanetary Scintillation Array to study quasars, which had just been recently discovered. Incidentally, I first learned of scintillation while at university in Ottawa, and not quite grasping the concept, phoned a department at the National Research Council. And you can well imagine my surprise when a voice said, "Dr. Geiger here." I stumbled out, "Geiger as in Geiger counter?" To which he responded with an accent, "That was my father." Anyway, back to Jocelyn Bell, who in 2018 was awarded the Special Breakthrough Prize in Fundamental Physics worth $3 million for her discovery of radio pulsars in 1968. Now, in a marvelous display of altruism, Dr. Bell then donated all the money to fund women, underrepresented ethnic minorities, and refugee students to become physics researchers. Well, here on Space Talks, we'd like to honor Dr. Bell, who displayed whimsy in initially labeling the pulsating radio sources as being generated by little green men.
That's all the time we have today on Space Talks, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did in researching it, and believe me, a lot to research. Until next time, this is Tim Woods.
And Stephen Lowry, inviting you to tune in next week when we try to unravel and understand the immense distances and temperatures inherent in space. And until then, so long, and we'll see you next time on Space Talks.